Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are so many adult children living with their parents these days? And is the trend something to welcome or something to worry about? An estimated 85% of U.S. college graduates move home for at least a short time after finishing their education. And overall, the number of multi-generational adult American households grew by nearly 75% in the first decade of this century. The trend is due at least in part to a job market that has been less than welcoming to younger workers and is redefining family relationships in the U.S. and abroad. Catherine S. Newman is dean of the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences and professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Her new book is The Accordion Family, Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. Catherine, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
So your title, Accordion Families, is like an ideal metaphor. It's households that expand and contract and expand and contract due to the needs of adult children.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So why is all this happening now?
It's actually been going on for quite a long time, Chris. Many people think it's a phenomenon of the recession, but it's not. It's certainly gotten worse in the recession, but this is a trend that's been underway for quite some time. You can see these numbers starting to grow in the 1980s. And I think it's a consequence of a number of different issues simultaneously. In Western Europe and in Japan, it is a consequence of the way the youth labor market almost completely collapsed. And what took its place were short-term contracts, part-time jobs, really much worse working conditions than prevailed before. In the U.S., we've also seen a kind of crunch in the entry-level labor market, and it's been accompanied by demands for much higher educational credentials. And they cost a lot of money to acquire, so it now becomes necessary for our young people to have master's degrees where they used to have only bachelor's degrees, or to have a lot of work experience that's unpaid in the form of internships in order to qualify for the kinds of jobs they're looking for. And under those circumstances, the only thing that makes sense for many middle-income families is to retrieve those kids, put them under one roof that's paid for by the in of mom and dad, and that subsidizes the march toward greater educational credentials and unpaid experience, which is necessary to platform into the kinds of positions that not only the young people want, but their families want for them. So it's a long-term secular trend that has emphasized the rewards to the high-skilled and made it much more difficult for everyone else.
It is easy to forget because we've now had a couple of generations where it was customary to finish school and move out on one's own. But in fact, it wasn't until World War II and after World War II that it became the norm for young adults to move right out.
That's true. Of course, the war itself made a difference. When we created the GI Bill and for the first time enabled people who came from families with modest means to go to college, they did start moving out from their families. They often were living as boarders. And my father was a boarder in someone's house when he went to college as a first-generation college student. So that movement began to some degree during the war itself. But you're right. After the Second World War, what we saw was enormous prosperity in the country, and that was reflected in the downward drift of the age of marriage. So young people were marrying much younger. They had much larger families. They were able to be autonomous from their families at a young age because they married so young. Men could support their families on a single income. And all of that began to change in the mid-1970s when we started to see income inequality grow. More and more women pressed into the labor market, both because they wanted to be there and because their families needed them to make up for the stagnating wages of their husbands. And we start to see a real change in youth labor market opportunities at that point. So the beginnings of the accordion family go way back before the Second World War, but they didn't last as long as they do now because young people did get married at a somewhat younger age than they do now.
So those young people who were moving out and getting married in the mid to late 70s are exactly the ones who are now in a position to be thinking about their own retirement. What impact does having a millennial child move back in have on mom and dad's ability to save for themselves?
Well, there's a good news, bad news story here. The good news side of it is less financial and more social. I found that many American parents actually felt themselves to be younger when their children moved back in because, in a sense, they retrieved an identity that we normally attach to people who are younger. They were active parents. They were busy. They were accompanying their kids in the way that they did before they left home. And in a sense, from a sociological point of view, they retrieved a status as active parent, which is very different from the empty nester, the grandparent, or any of the other identities that go with the more mature state of elderhood, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So from a social point of view, the parents often felt much younger when their kids moved home. From a financial point of view, however, you know, they were often digging into resources that they would have preferred in some ways to save for their own retirement, as they're having to spend more and more of their income taking care of the younger generation, which isn't so young anymore. They're not able to save as much for retirement, and they may find at the end of the day that they've really dug themselves into a hole. And when that's compounded by the losses of housing equity as a result of the real estate bubble bursting, we could be looking at some really serious issues with respect to how our baby boomers will fare when they are the elders.
Yeah, and in fact, some of those baby boomers now have a 25-year-old at home and a 75-year-old parent moving back in.
It's true. We are seeing a growth in these so-called sandwich families. At the same time, we're seeing more and more truly elderly on their own than we ever had before, and a huge increase in the proportion of people over 70 who have headed back into the labor market.
Hmm.
So one way we could understand the accordion family phenomenon is that it isn't really just about what happened to young people. It's about the whole lifespan elongating. We are working longer, some of us, than we ever have before. We're having children much later than we ever did before. We have a record proportion of first-time births over the age of 40 for the mother. Nobody used to have kids when they were over 40. But we're pushing all those biological limits because the whole lifespan is expanding as it takes longer to complete education, longer to find a decent job, longer to find a partner, longer to settle down and have a family. And when we have those families, they're way smaller than they used to be. And that's what we see in Western Europe and Japan. We're just seeing a real collapse in fertility, which has its own huge consequences for these societies.
Let's talk a little bit about Japan, because this phenomenon is taking place there as well, and where American families may view this as a sort of temporary, necessary thing. In Japan, it feels like a crisis of bad parenting somehow.
Yes, I found this absolutely fascinating in a macabre sort of way. You know, Japan hit the economic skids quite a long time ago. They have had what they call the lost decade, and it's now stretched out to probably two decades or more of economic stagnation. And it rearranged the youth labor market in some pretty dramatic ways. So Japan was famous for the long-term lifetime employee who started working as a young man and stayed with the same company forever and ever. And all that began to change in the 1980s. And for the first time, you started to see people getting fired. Nobody ever got fired in Japan before. You saw the trajectory for young people in the labor market shift dramatically. So instead of getting lifetime jobs, they now were getting part-time, short-term jobs. And they created a whole category called the freeter in Japan, which means sort of the almost an involuntary part-time status. And it's not a compliment to call someone a freeter. It's a failure, in a sense, to meet up to the expectations the Japanese have of what an adult worker looks like. But it became rampant among young adults, and those young adults aren't so young anymore. This has been going on for 20 years. What I found interesting was that with all those structural conditions producing the accordion family in Japan, with record numbers of people in their 30s living at home, was that I never heard Japanese parents describe the reasons why this happened from an economic point of view. They never, ever mentioned the economy, the bursting bubble, none of that. It was always about those terrible young people who are somehow defective, grew up badly, and then why did they grow up badly? And the lens starts to turn back on the Japanese parents asking themselves, how did they produce a defective generation?
So the stigma is actually greater for the parents than for the children, adult children who need some help.
Well, it was in both directions. It wasn't good for either group, but it certainly extended to the parents, who then blamed themselves or blamed the kind of marital arrangements they had that were so common then, in which the man was working every hour that was ever made in the salaryman positions, where basically you had absent fathers.
Mm-hmm.
But they were absent because they were working 80 hours a week and never home. And so very often I would hear Japanese mothers say that the reason their sons were so defective was that the fathers were never there and the moral center of the family had disintegrated. We hear this sometimes said among people who are trying to explain why poor people in the U.S. don't turn out the way somehow people think they should, the absent father. In Japan, that's a middle-class model of a hardworking, overworked father who is not available to his children. So I found that really intriguing because there's every reason in the world to talk about the economic collapse in Japan as the reason why you have accordion families, and it just wasn't the way they thought about it at all.
Meanwhile, you go to Spain, and families are not blaming these adult children. They're not blaming the parents. They are looking at the economy and particularly the government and saying, why have you failed to create an environment where young people can get good work?
Exactly. Now, why is that the case? Why, with exactly the same pattern of household formation, do you have such a different explanation or culture surrounding this issue? And the answer I give in the book is that the adults who are parents in in Spain right now are very much products of a protest period that lasted a long time around the end of the Franco administration. The Franco government, which was the fascist government in Spain, only ended in the mid-1970s. It was an extremely conservative, strict, traditional government that forbade birth control, insisted on early marriage, very extremely conservative. And the generation that our parents now protested against this and were vehement and political in their consciousness more or less throughout their youth. And so their explanations for many things tend first to go towards structural conditions, government, elites, big business, a whole bolus of actors that stand outside of the family. So you have exactly the same economic forces and pretty much the same demographic responses in Japan and Spain, and completely different explanations for why these things happened.
And one other example is you go to Scandinavian countries, places like Denmark and Sweden, and it's not that young people are able to stand on their own two feet, but they are moving out because there is a great deal of government sustenance.
That's exactly right. I went to Scandinavian countries because I thought I would find the place where the accordion family didn't exist, and in a sense, the problem I was studying wasn't a problem. It was nirvana and paradise. And what I found was that unemployment is actually a very serious problem for young people in the Nordic countries. It's really not much different from other countries in Western Europe. But the consequences of unemployment are very different in these social democracies. They protect young people from the consequences. They have extremely generous unemployment benefits so that there's very little income poverty. They're very, very helpful in subsidizing housing. Higher education is largely free. So too is elder care, child care, all of these issues which are really very much on the minds of Americans and others as to how in the world we're going to manage all of these obligations. It's pretty well taken care of in the Scandinavian countries. They do pay very high taxes, but what they get back is cradle-to-grave care, in a sense, from the government. Now,
let me jump in because we need to take a break. You can finish that thought in just a moment.
Do.
My guest is Catherine S. Newman, Dean of the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Her new book is called The Accordion Family, Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. You can join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Thank you.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Catherine S. Newman, Dean of the Krieger School of the Arts and Sciences and Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins. Her new book is called The Accordion Family, Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. You can join us, ask a question, or perhaps share your own family's story at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. And Catherine, before the break, you were telling us that the Nordic countries do, in fact, have this cradle-to-grave support, and I sense there was a but coming.
Well, yeah. So the thing is that you'd think that this would mean they have no problems. After all, they don't exhibit any of the symptoms that I was describing elsewhere in the accordion family. But it turns out that when you talk to Scandinavian parents and their kids, they sort of lament the fact that they aren't together more. They question whether this comfort provided by the state means that they don't need each other as much as they do in other countries, and whether they might have gone too far in uncoupling the generations through the generosity of the state. And I was so stunned to hear this. It never occurred to me that you could go too far, in a sense, create people who felt lonely because they didn't need each other. But when I asked the Nordic families, why do Spanish families look so different from yours, they would say, well, you know, we think they love each other more than we do.
Hmm.
And there was a real lament behind that that really did surprise me.
So I want to talk a little bit about the dynamics within these families. Anyone who's raising an adolescent now, or not anyone, but a lot of people might be wishing for the day when they are sort of free of the day-to-day parenting responsibilities. Some of that is gone, and in a nice way, when adult children move back home.
That's true. When they come back, they don't come back in the same form in which they left. They come back, in a sense, free of all those needs for surveillance. You don't ask Sammy whether he's going to be home at midnight, and you don't hover over Sally to see if she's finished her homework, and you don't worry about whether or not they're going to get into college. All of those things that can make the adolescent life with parents somewhat stressful sort of disappear. And in particular, if the relationship was reasonably good before they left, it can often mean it's even better when they come back, because all of those nasty aspects are gone, and what's in its place is a lot of friendship and love and affection and a lot more cultural similarity than I think most people realize. When you think back to the baby boom generation and its relations with its parents, those were tense relations because the boomers were so different. Their culture was different, their politics were different, their music was different, and that created a gulf that we used to call the generation gap. But it's not there anymore. When you talk to boomer parents who are taking care of their own kids, they like the same music. Everybody's listening to the Rolling Stones.
Mm-hmm.
The Rolling Stones are 68 years old, and people are still rocking out to them. And those people are 16 years old and 60 years old. So there's a lot more cultural similarity, a lot more educational similarity, and it makes the experience of living together easier than it did in earlier generations.
Of course, having adult children and giving them some freedom and that they deserve because they are adults as they're living in the house also raises the question of privacy. Adult children have sex lives.
Right, or they'd like to.
Yeah,
so here again, I found that it was much easier than you might have expected because of who the parents are. The parents come from the generation that broke all the rules on sexual relations and are hardly in a position to turn around and make a big deal out of this with their own kids. These are parents who often lived together before they married, had, you know, many sexual partners over the course of their youth. They were the first generation to use birth control in large numbers. And so it's not as big of an issue as one might imagine. Nonetheless, no young man in his right mind really wants to conduct his private life under the nose of his parents. There needs to be some kind of privacy, and people do go to great lengths to try and kind of maneuver around those privacy boundaries and give people some sense of autonomy when they're actually not really autonomous. It's sort of in-house adulthood, which is different from being the full-blown version.
One country that came up in the book that we haven't yet discussed is Italy. And I think this is a fascinating example of one other way that this can go. In Italy, it is not only expected that adults may live with their parents, but sons in particular have no motivation to move out unless they go off and get married.
Yeah, and they don't do that at a very young age. So today, 37% of Italian young men who are age 30 have never left home. Never. It's not just they don't go away and come back. They just don't leave. Now, that's partly because young people in Italy have always stayed home until they married, but the age of marriage is just getting later and later and later. So Italy, this country famous for huge generations and big families, now has below replacement fertility, and young people are not marrying and forming new households. And if they do, they do it much later in life, and they have many, many fewer children than they ever did before. And in turn, and this I found intriguing, when I talked to Italian women who were in their late 50s, they never mentioned the desire for grandchildren, which really surprised me because their own mothers would have had dozens of grandchildren, but they didn't talk about it. And you wonder, well, why not? Why did this need or expectation or desire suddenly wane among them? And the answer is they didn't lose their jobs as mothers.
Hmm.
Their sons and daughters are still there. And so that desire for grandchildren tends to come about when that mothering role has been left dormant for quite a while. Well, it isn't. It isn't dormant at all. And so I found it quite remarkable that on a sunny summer Sunday in Italy, you would go to a playground built for children and you just never saw a child. You never saw a child. You didn't hear a child's voice. The country's getting older. For all these reasons.
And in this country, even if this trend continues, we don't have to worry about that because we have a great deal of immigration. But in places like Japan and Italy, in fact, the declining population rates are a major cause for concern.
They are, because there's no real tradition of immigration to speak of in those two countries. Now, we're starting to see more immigration from other countries in the Far East into Japan than there was before. There has long been a Korean population in Japan, but it's a very stigmatized role. It's not been an immigration-friendly country and nowhere near like the United States in the rates of immigration. So what protects us in the U.S. from having the kind of population slowdown that we see in these other countries is our immigrant population. And we wax and wane in how comfortable we are with immigration. We occasionally see these anti-immigrant movements spring up all around the country. They tend to get more pronounced when the economy slows down. But fundamentally, the U.S. has been an immigration-friendly country relative to the rest of the developed world for quite a long time. Immigrants tend to have larger families than the native-born for one or two generations, and then they just migrate to the mean, and they start looking like the native-born within a short period of time. But for a while, they have larger families. And that is keeping our population up at replacement level. It's changing its composition, but its overall demographics don't look as shockingly different. But if you look just at the American-born, you know, native population in the middle and upper middle class, you'd see very, very sharp contraction in fertility there, too.
Catherine, I know it's probably hard to generalize, but talk a little bit about how in this country, accordion families set the rules for things like housework and financial contributions.
Yeah, there aren't any hard and fast rules, and they can be the subject of complicated negotiations. I do think accordion families work best when the expectations are discussed and when the generations have a clear understanding of one another, but often they're not discussed, and so you get young people coming home and expecting the kinds of services, if you will, that they had when they were younger.
Meals and laundry.
Who's doing the laundry? Who's paying the bills? And some resentments can grow if that's not openly discussed. It is rare in the middle class for parents to ask their children to pay rent. It's very common in the working class and absolutely the rule of thumb among the poor, because poor households in the U.S. depend on multiple earners pooling their earnings and contributing them to the support of the household. So much so that in our poorest households, when young people are ready to move out on their own, their parents don't want them to, and try to undermine their efforts to leave because they need that money to keep the household afloat. So this, the expectations inside American households vary a great deal depending on how wealthy they are.
So what happens when these families come into conflict over one of these things? Is it an issue often of the young person being asked to leave?
Well, it can get very tense for quite a while, and it can shatter relationships that, you know, that are very valuable to people and can be very, very sad from that point of view. But most often I find it goes the other way. Most often I find that the children come to see their parents as people they value and treasure, and it probably improves their relationship over the life course, such that when the parents get to be very old, they know their children are more likely to help them because there was a more recent period of reciprocal support. But it can be tense, and I find it's especially tense if it was bad before. It doesn't get better when young people come back if their interpersonal relations with their parents were bad in the past.
Is there any tension in families where more than one sibling might want to move home and perhaps there aren't adequate resources or enough room to have that happen?
Yes, and I think, of course, this varies according, again, to the resources families have, including how big their houses are.
Mm-hmm.
I've interviewed families that had, you know, kids who were closely spaced who came back home at more or less the same time. And if they haven't moved, if those parents haven't downsized, then they still have the space. I think the conflict will develop if, for various economic reasons, the parents were planning on downsizing that big house and reaping some of the cash benefits out of it to support their own retirement needs, and now they can't because they've got a full house again. So I think for a period of time when the returnees are in their early 20s up to their mid-20s, it's not so much of an issue. When it grows to the late 20s, early 30s, now you're really pushing the limits, at least in the U.S. context, less so in Italy.
What sort of progress do American parents want to be assured their children are making toward independence?
They do want to see a plan. They are eager to see that their children are making steps forward, which could include finding unpaid internships that give them experience that will help them find a better job later. It could include getting a master's degree or some other advanced credential and limiting the debt piling up from their undergraduate years on top of that. It could mean taking a job for which they're getting very poorly paid, but it's got some potential for the future. And so it's worth that entry-level penalty, if you will. What they get really nervous about is no action, no plan.
Video games in the basement all day.
Video games in the basement. Now, I have to say, I very rarely saw that.
Mm-hmm.
It is a media preoccupation, and we read about it more than I saw it. Most young people are quite anxious to be able to stand on their own two feet. But this is a tough economy, and their best efforts may lead them nowhere right now, even though they're really trying, because with unemployment as high as it is, it can be very difficult. Now, we should all thank our lucky stars that we're not in Spain, where youth unemployment is now at 50%. Mm. I mean, that's like the Great Depression. Spain is in the Great Depression again, and that is terrifying. We are nowhere near that level, but it's still pretty difficult, and the brunt of the trouble has landed often on entry-level workers.
There's also this idea among the millennial generation that they really want work that is meaningful to them. And it sounds like to the extent possible, middle-class parents at least are willing to support this for a while, holding out for the right job.
I think that's true. After all, many of these families have sacrificed enormous amounts of money to put their children through higher education, and they're sort of hoping that's going to pay off. I mean, if they've spent $200,000 getting Johnny a degree from a private university, they don't really want to see Johnny start off at the bottom flipping burgers, because what was all that for? And so they do think that holding out for something better makes sense given what they've already invested in putting Johnny ahead. And after all, we tend to think of careers as something that inhabits an individual, but it's really a kind of family project. It's a trajectory over the family's multiple generations. And there's a lot of pride and expectations that parents and status linked up in what your children are doing for a living. So when parents get together with their bridge partners or their you know, their buddies, and they say, well, what's your child doing today? And what's Johnny doing? They don't want to have to say, Johnny's working at Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
They have, so there is a certain way in which each person is carrying the football, if you will, for the whole family across the generations, and they want to see them cross into the end zone, and that means a job people can be proud of. I think also many parents would trade, to some degree, the financial success of their children for the intrinsic value of what they do. So they were willing to accept the idea that Johnny may not make a fortune if he's working for an NGO on, I don't know, drought in West Africa, because that's an honorable contribution to the well-being of the world. And so it's not always because they're holding out for Johnny to make a mint. It may be because they're holding out for the opportunity for him to do something that is intrinsically valuable and, you know, helps save the world.
So I'm 41, and when I graduated from school, there would have been a stigma to living with my parents for any extended period of time. What's happened to that stigma for millennials who may have a lot of friends in the same boat?
I do think that stigma has declined. It has not completely evaporated. So I've been interested, as I've done these interviews on many NPR stations, they often try to find young people to join the program to illustrate in a live voice what they're going through. And it can be difficult for them to find them, not because they aren't there, but because they're a little uneasy about advertising their situation. So there's still some of that stigma there, and it comes from the fact that you've got two generations side by side with very different economic histories and very different expectations. When I was 18, I left home at 17. I never went back. I never would have even considered it. It would have been a complete anathema for someone in my generation to do that. But that's not true for my children. My 22-year-old came home when he finished college, and he spent 6 months at home working for the United Nations in New York City. And that was a great opportunity for him. He couldn't have done it if we couldn't put a roof over his head. But most of his friends had come home.
Hmm.
Now they've all gone back out into the world again in various and sundry guises. So as it becomes more and more the normal experience, it becomes less and less stigmatized.
My guest is Catherine S. Newman, Dean of the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Her new book is called The Accordion Family, Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. If you've got a story to share or you'd like to ask a question, you can do that by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Catherine S. Newman, Dean of the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Her new book is called The Accordion Family, Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we hear from Doug in Fort Worth. Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Hi.
So many things of this conversation are resonating with me. I have a daughter who's about to graduate in 2 weeks, and she's pursuing the arts, and sort of our discussions are about whether she should come back home until she gets the job or whether I supplement her income as she stays out there pursuing it, and I'm inclined for the latter. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think this is something that families who are relatively well-heeled can consider, and they may decide that it's really better for their kids to stay out on their own even if it costs them. And if you can afford to do that and it works for your child, of course, that's fine. Many families do that. It's not an opportunity open to everyone, but it is an opportunity that some of the more fortunate can can pursue. And I think, you know, depends a lot on your child's expectations, what it is she's trying to accomplish and whether she can accomplish it where she is better than moving back home. I don't really think there's a single answer to this question. It's really whatever works for your family. It sounds like you've already figured that out.
Did you meet any young Americans who said, I could probably swing it with a roommate, but my parents have such a nice house. Why would I want to leave?
I did hear people say, I could swing it with a roommate, but I'd be living in a dive,
yeah.
And I'd rather live in a place that's more comfortable. And that's an issue we haven't talked about in the program so far, but it is not trivial. There are expectations that are important to this generation of young people about their standard of living that did not matter to earlier generations who were happy to slum it in favor of autonomy. So I think, I do think that there's a question of cultural taste involved here, and very often this generation is voting in favor of comfort where earlier generations might have voted in favor of blue jeans with holes in them.
Well, and I guess this comes back once again to the narrowing, if not lack, of a generation gap. If parents have made it comfortable to be oneself, even as a young adult with slightly different ideas, they're less inclined to leave home to get what they want.
Well, some people really worry about that. They do, and I think whenever you have a change that happens in a single generation and people are unsure about its value, in a sense, or its wisdom, you get people worrying that maybe they're making things too easy for young people to stay home and that they might be contributing to a kind of infantilization that will turn around and bite them. And I suppose that's always a possibility. It's not, we don't have a science of this. We have one new generation's experience, and that can be, it could be difficult to rely on that for a real kind of North Star in this experience. I think every family has to be on guard and looking out for the importance of their young person's thinking about the future and planning for themselves. If they see that come to a halt, it's probably not a good sign.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, we can expect longer lifespans, we take longer to get our education, we may stay in the workforce longer. Do you think that we are at the start of a redefining of what it means to be an adolescent and what it means to be fully adult?
I think that's already very much underway. There is a kind of intermediate category that didn't used to exist at all, which is the in-house adult, or at least that's the way I talked about it in the book. It is a state of defining oneself with some degree of maturity, but not complete autonomy. It's really a limbo kind of status. It's not independence, and it's not complete self-reliance, but it's not being a teenager either. It's somewhere in between, and I think we are starting to add these way stations along the way in the lifespan that are engulfing not only young people, but their parents. What does it mean to be someone who's 65 years old but still has a child at home and still is providing for them and still is making dinner and doing all the things that would have stopped 15 years before in earlier generations? That's a new kind of elderhood, if you want to call it, as well. So I think we have a very plastic kind of life structure before us with some destinations that are really unknown to us.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Beth in Plano. Hi, Beth.
Hi, great show.
Thanks.
I'm so disheartened to hear this. I'm a parent of two young teenagers, and the speaker hit the nail on the head when she mentioned autonomy and this expectation of this high level of comfort, which they're not entitled to, and it's just so hard as a parent, you know, to watch these kids come home and expect all these things when they should be out working, maybe getting a second job and a roommate, making it on their own, not expecting mom and dad to clean up after them. I know that, you know, I tell my kids, when you graduate and go to college, we're selling our house, we're moving. So, I mean, really, and as an employer, these kids I've had, these entitled kids, I've had their parents actually apply the jobs for them. So I hope they grow up.
Thanks for your call.
It's not a good trend.
What do you think about all that, Catherine?
I think that can be a real, well, obviously your caller is frustrated about it, and
yeah,
she's not alone. There are other people who are frustrated too, but I think we sometimes lose sight of how very difficult the economy is and how high the expectations are for advanced credentials now that really weren't asked of us when we were younger. It can be very easy sometimes to forget what a struggle it is out there. I mean, youth unemployment now in the United States is about three times as high as it was for any of your callers in the baby boom generation. That really does have consequences. So, yeah, we have to look out for behaviors that become self-indulgent and that will frustrate everyone because nobody's going to get anywhere if they don't try. On the other hand, we do have to understand this recession has driven us almost as deep as the Great Depression on many dimensions, and that's not trivial. And, you know, in 1929, when the Great Crash happened, there were lots of Americans who didn't understand what happened and just thought, why isn't Daddy finding a job? And they were disgusted with him for not doing so, having held him to a standard that wasn't reachable anymore. And, you know, we have really seen some pretty significant damage out there in the labor market. So while I appreciate the caller's moral stature, and I think it's important not to lose sight of what everyone's responsibilities are, at the same time, we really have to recognize it is a hard world out there right now.
One thing that's come up a lot in my industry in journalism is that it's tough to find your first good job without having done one, if not a number, of unpaid internships. And in an industry where we want a lot of diversity, frankly, that's not a possibility for people from lower income families. They can't afford to have kids working for months on end without drawing a paycheck.
Well, that's exactly right. And here the accordion family intersects a bigger debate on economic inequality, which has been growing by leaps and bounds across the developed world. And we are seeing this replicated from one generation to the next as differential opportunities become available to some and scarce for others. I mean, the fact that my son could come home and we could put a roof over his head while he got this vital experience, which I have no doubt is going to make a huge difference in his future long run, really separates him from friends of his whose families had to have them work, couldn't possibly have let them go without earning, will not have internships like that, and they will not have careers like his.
Mm-hmm.
That is handing off from one generation to the next a set of constraints or opportunities. It is not leaving everybody at square one. It is introducing some real differentials that have lifetime consequences. And that, I have to say, as an educator, really breaks my heart because it's not about meritocracy. It's about who has, you know, the goods to put behind the next generation. And that's unfair, and it's unfortunate.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Stevie in Denton. Hi, Stevie.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Okay, I just wanted to comment because it seems like a lot of the people I'm hearing of who are calling are speaking from the perspective of a parent. And I just wanted to give a perspective from someone who's a little younger. I'm 21 years old, and I live in Denton. I moved out of my parents' house when I was 17 and came here from East Texas, Nacogdoches. And I heard someone talking about autonomy and some sense of entitlement that that they think that our generation has. And I just wanted to say that there actually is a big number of us who didn't want any support from their parents, and even though I have, you know, unbelievable amounts of support, they even wanted me to stay home and you know, go to school near them, and I just I rejected all that, and instead I moved out and I went to school when I was 17, and I moved in with a roommate, and you know, like it's hard for me to imagine feeling entitled to anything like the speakers are talking about, because, you know, I'm 21 and I feel like I have two jobs and I work really hard to pay rent and, you know, buy food for my dog and just be able to go out to eat sometimes. But I think that you guys might have our generation wrong. I don't think we have a sense of entitlement. I think that a lot of parents are just babying their kids and, you know, like just, yeah, come home anytime and live here and instead of going out and doing all these things on your own and learning from your mistakes specifically. I know that my parents were always, you know, I have a really great relationship with my parents, but they understand that in order for me to become what they are, I have to come out and do things on my own. And you know, it is a tough economy, but that's tough. And it's just, you know, what other world have we ever known?
Well, Stevie, you put a lot on the table there. Let's give Catherine a chance to respond to some of that.
So I admire the speaker. I did exactly what he did. I left home at 17, and I worked on my own and never got any support from anybody. But I will have to tell you, this is an unusual experience now, and I bet if he thinks about all the kids he went to high school with, he would probably see himself as unusual in that company, because we have a record number of young people who are living with their parents. We have seen more than 2 million households added to the list of multi-generation households of this kind in the last 5 years. So I think the tide of the moment is moving in a different direction, but that doesn't mean it's universal. Nothing is universal. There are always people going in the other direction. And I would say that even those young people who have found their way home for all kinds of reasons rarely feel entitled. I think the term entitlement is overreaching. I see them feeling grateful for the opportunities. I think they appreciate what is being done for them. I think they understand a little bit better what the struggle out there in the adult world is really like. But I rarely see a sense of entitlement in the sense of not appreciating what is being done to help them. I also think it's a mistake for us to believe that families have no purpose in the world. They have a purpose. And one of those purposes can be supporting one another through the generations. After all, for most of our history, older people came home and lived with their kids when they needed their help, and that was the norm then too. So the notion that the only normal state of existence is complete independence and autonomy between generations, I think, can be taken too far as well.
Should we assume that if people are staying home longer and marrying later, that those marriages will have a better chance of success?
You know, I don't think we know the answer to that question. I really don't, because we haven't seen this happen before,
right,
where marriage became the provenance of older people. There is some reason to imagine that might be the case, because they're more stable, they know themselves better, they have possibly a more secure footing in life, and that certainly those elements can help make marriages more stable. But we have no experience with this. We're just going to have to wait and see on that one.
What do you say to parents who are worried? They have opened their homes and they're happy to have their kids there, but they worry they're making, they're sort of setting themselves up for a lot more commitment.
I think, again, the best thing to do is to be honest about your concerns and not to just moan and groan behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. Communication does make a difference. But I have to say, I am a sociologist, not an advice therapist. I think there are other people who can convert the observations that we social scientists contribute into advice. But my general experience is that families that talk about what they're expecting and why they're concerned do better than those who fume silently.
You think the boomerang will swing the other way when the economy gets better?
I think it will to some degree, but some of the long-term changes that predated the recession mm-hmm. are probably here to stay. I don't think we're going to see demands for less education. I think it's going to grow, and we have certainly not cracked the higher education financing problem to the point where people are going to be able to breeze into master's degrees. It's going to be costly for them for a long time. So some of these forces at work I don't think are going to go away. I think we're going to adapt to it, and it's going to become more normative. I think we will see this class pattern of advantage and disadvantage, the parents who can afford to set their kids up in an apartment separately.
Got to jump in here. We are out of time. The new book by Catherine S. Newman is called The Accordion Family, Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. Catherine, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, which you can find at kera.org/think. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. If you've got comments, you can send those to think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.